Do you want me to tell that story? Okay. Two things I have to do is he just handed me the mic and said, "Oop, I forgot to plug your CDs." Plug. I hate that word. Unless it's, you know, for the tub or something when you need a plug. But that was really not a joke. It was just bad, whatever it was. I only have... I'm not here to plug these. But the last time I came, the last two times I came, I didn't bring extra CDs. And both places yelled at me. So I brought them. So they're out there. I slash them down to 10 bucks, and so they're there. The two that I have, just so that you know, this first one is the first time I ever recorded Dance With Me. I just written it and recorded it, and I thought it was too feminine. So I almost didn't put it on my CD. And everybody around me hit me and hurt me and said, "You better put that on there because that's going to be a really good song." I'm very grateful for people that hit me then. The interesting thing is that I was sitting at home singing "We Will Dance on the Street to the Golden." Anybody know that song, that old David Ruth song? I love it. It's in 6/8 time. It's waltz. And I'm sitting there in my living room just worshiping. And my youngest daughter comes in. And she'd been a dancer since she was 4 years old. Now she was 11 or 12, something like that. She comes in and sits down next to me. She has a beautiful voice, and she just knows how to harmonize instantly, any song. And so she sits down and she starts harmonizing to "We Will Dance on the Streets That Are Golden." And I'm just sitting there, and I'm just thinking, "Oh, this is so wonderful." And then she gets up and runs away. I'm thinking, "Oh, darn it. I just love that moment." And about 4 or 5 minutes later, she comes out of her bedroom in her dance whites with a veil that just floats in the air. And she starts dancing around the living room, waltzing to "We Will Dance on the Streets That Are Golden." And my eyes just filled up watching her as a papa. I just like, wow, my daughter is dancing unashamed before her father. And it just doesn't get any better than that. And I'm thinking, "Lord, you take me right now. This is a bit." And I thought, no, I want to enjoy her for a long. And suddenly the Lord just whispered to me. He says, "That's how I feel about you." I said, "What?" He goes, "The song 'We Will Dance on the Streets of the Golden' is about everybody. A billion people or more dancing on golden streets." He said, "I love that, but I love it when I just dance with you." And suddenly, 5 minutes later, "Dance With Me" was written. But it was from God's point of view. Now, we sing it from our point of view. When I wrote it, it was from God's point of view. And changed a little bit of the dialogue. So at first, I wrote it as a father to a daughter and had daughter phrases in it. And then I just felt like the Lord said, "No, I want this to be something that can be sung by everyone from my heart to theirs and their heart to mine." So that's why the terminology is a little different. I was in Texas a couple years later, and I was at a conference, and I did that song at the end of the conference. And I was sitting on the edge of the stage, and we were talking. There's about 10 or 12 people around talking. And it was just, you know, one of those afterglow times. It was real sweet. And this young kid, about 18, 19 years old, comes up to me, and he goes, "Excuse me, sir?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "A Dance With Me song." I said, yeah. He said, you don't sing that right." And those other 10 people that are standing around just went, got real quiet. You know, "What's he going to do?" And I said, "Really? Well, what am I doing wrong?" He goes, "Well, actually, two things." I thought, this is great. I said, "What's that?" And everybody is just quiet as can be. They just want to know what's going to happen. And I just thought it was funny. And he goes, "Number one, you go, 'Dance with me, oh lover.' It's not that. It's not 'Dance with me.' It's 'Dance with me, oh.'" I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, because that's how the guy Paul Wilbur did it on the recording." I said, "Oh, okay." And he said, "The other thing is that you separated your verses and put 'Dance With Me' in the middle. You don't separate the verses. You keep the verses together." I said, "Oh, okay. Well, listen, you do it your way, and I'll do it my way, and hopefully the Lord will show up in both ways. And then, you know, you're comfortable, I'm comfortable." And he goes, "Yeah, it's okay. I just wanted you to know what you did wrong." It's okay. That's fine. I said, "Hey, I have to go." So I went on purpose because they were all crowded around him. And I walked away to like a place like that corner, and I went around the corner, and then I went like this. Because I knew that they were going to bombard him, and his face was facing me that way. That's why I walked that way. And suddenly I'm watching his face, he's going, no. And he just, it was great. So it was Super Bowl Sunday, and the pastor invited me over to his house. So I drove my rental car over and knocked on the door, and who opens the door with this young kid? He looks at me and goes, no. I said, hi, your dad invited me for dinner. He goes, I'm so sorry. So anyway, I thought that was great. That's the, so anyway, just to make it easier on whoever is out there selling these, if you're going to get, this is the one that's 10 songs, kind of all acoustic with some violin, cello, and that kind of thing. And it's all worship stuff. We did it at Metro for years, and they're kind of all along the lines of Dance With Me. This one had a different cover, and I like the other cover better. So why is this one on there? I'll tell you why. Because the guys from that published The Shack, I don't know if you ever heard of the book The Shack, they got a hold of this with a different cover, called me and said, most beautiful instrumental CD I've heard in 15, 20 years. It's just piano. I took 12 songs from 5 CDs, had my favorite keyboard player play them, and he said, we want that, we want to advertise it, we want to put it in the back of the book, we want to put it on the website and advertise it both places. Can you change the name? And do you mind changing the cover? I want them to look more like the Shack look. So they put a little girl on it with a little red outfit, which is the Shack girl, and then changed it to the 5th song called My Beautiful One. So anyway, that's out. That's just all instrumental. Don't yell at me because I didn't sing on it. People do that all the time. You're not singing. I know, that's why it says instrumental. Do you have that one? Do you know? Okay. There you go. So, I'll give you another one later. It was a joke. Okay. You'll get your own. So you've been in Luke 15? Have you been in Luke 15? Not lately? Go to Luke 15. He loves you more than you can ever imagine. Psalm 139. Now get this for a second. If I took a gallon jug and I filled it with fine grains of sand, I would have approximately 1 to 1.5 billion grains of sand. Psalm 39 says this in verses 17 and 18, I think. It says, his thoughts to me are good. The word good means lovingly embrace. His thoughts to me, he lovingly embraces me with his thoughts, and they number more than the grains of sand. Now, how many good thoughts does God have about you? Trillions, quadrillions, whatever. I don't know. How many grains of sand? I love Cape Cod, and we go to a place called Coast Guard Beach. And Coast Guard Beach is sand as far as I can look that way and as far as I can look that way. There's more than a gallon of sand. There's more than a truckload of sand. There's endless amounts of sand, and that's one beach. And God's thoughts to me lovingly embrace me, and they number more than the grains of sand. So don't let the enemy tell you different. Why do we think we have 2 or 3 good things to offer when what eternity we think, hear me, part of eternity is you proclaiming God's holiness and goodness and grace, and part of eternity is him telling you all the billions of ways he loves you. It's not, if God created a one-way relationship, that's what it would be, but it's not. So don't think eternity is all you, oh, I don't, and you go, I'm going to get tired of worshiping. Number one, you won't. But number two, the other side of that relationship is him telling you, okay, this grain of sand, that's for July 3rd, 1982. What'd I do? I'll tell you what you did July 3rd, 1982. And everybody hears it. He's incredible. My father didn't start out incredible. My father was one of, it was an older sister, then there were four boys, and they were so close together that they had a saying, when one of us has a dollar, we all have a quarter. And the oldest one graduated high school. The three younger ones, two were in high school, one was in junior high. They worked and put him through college. Then these three worked and put him through college. Then they put him through college, and then they put him through college. They became lawyers and teachers and professionals, et cetera, et cetera. It's incredible. And my father was old enough, young enough at the time, to be part of in World War II. He signed up shortly after he was of age. And I don't know why he did this, but he hated heights, so he joined the Air Force. I remember years later, I said, Dad, that was stupid. That I shouldn't have said that when I was a little boy, because number one, it was disrespectful. Number two, I got it. he was in a B-17, and they were just those machines just shook like tin cans. And on his 13th mission, he was shot down, and remember, one engine went out, another engine went out. the tail gunner is his best buddy. He was decapitated. He pushed the port side gunner, pulled his ripcord because he was unconscious, and then pushed him out the door, and he lived, and which was amazing. And then my father and the pilot jumped out at the same time. 3 seconds later, the plane exploded, and my father just fell to the ground from a couple miles up, and had never parachuted in his life, and he learned. At 1,500 feet, you pull the parachute, you pull the ripcord. You don't do it at 5,000 feet because you just sit there for everyone to shoot at you. And he said some guys pulled their ripcords too soon, and they were just fodder. They just were up there for the longest time. And then every now and then a guy would pull it too late, which is even worse. And that's not good. And so they taught them. Every time a plane went up and down, the pilot yelled out 15, which meant we're at 1,500 feet, so that they knew what it looked like, so that when they pull the ripcord, that's what it looks like. They're used to it. So he'd seen it dozens of times going up and down in planes. So he gets to what he thinks is 1,500 feet and pulls the ripcord. And he said to me, I learned a very valuable lesson that day. Never, under any circumstances, ever put your parachute on upside down. Because the second he pulled the ripcord, his legs went, boom. And now he's going like this towards the earth, head down. And he's at the moment that it twisted him so much that the muscle in his back separated from his back. So you know how it is when you get a little pull, and it's like, oh, and it's hard to reach something? Well, the whole muscle was pulled back. And now he's got to reach and pull his whole body so his head is up and his feet are down. And he's coming towards what he knows to be is a field. As he gets closer, now, I grew up in Rochester. Actually, I grew up 30 miles east of Rochester in a little farming community. And I grew up at 4 years old. I was driving Alice Chalmers and taking hay and straw, hay up to our cows that were on the top hill and doing the bit with straw and that you do. So he comes toward this field, and he realizes it's a field of corn that's been cut. And so it's like 1,000 swords going up into the air. And it's winter. It's January 1945. And you land on one of those, you're dead. So he moves it over to an area where there's no corn. And at the last minute, he realizes that's why there's no corn. Corn doesn't grow on boulders. But now it's too late. And he tries to turn, but his right leg hits the boulder and breaks in 9 places. I know this sounds horrible. Sounds like a bad movie. He's taken by the French underground, but they don't have the right medicine for him, so that they say, if you stay with us, your leg will have to be removed. But the Germans have the medicine. So we have to give you to the Germans. He says, well, I'll take the chance. So he goes and becomes a German prisoner. They give him medication. It makes sure he doesn't get gangrene. And they say, we're going to make you good enough so that you can go to, and then they said, Luft something. He didn't know what that meant. That was a German prison camp. And so they got him good enough, put the cast on him, made sure that he wouldn't get gangrene, and then sent him off to a Nazi camp, and where he spent the rest of the war in this little cubicle getting beaten on by young Germans who were mad at Americans because the war was coming to an end. My father went into the war. His nickname used to be Nice Guy Dave. It really was. They called him Nice Guy. He didn't come out Nice Guy Dave. My father came out a very mad, angry, bitter man who had elements of Nice Guy. But when pressure came on him, he turned into not Dr. Jekyll, but Mr. Hyde, if you know that story. I was the third one. The oldest one's a daughter, my sister, my brother. The second one came along. He was sick for the first 3 or 4 years of his life, spent a lot of time in a hospital with a blood disorder. Then I came along. I was a boy, and I was healthy, and I got the backhand. I got the kicks. I got the slaps. I got the throws. I got, you know, whatever it was. The problem was that I didn't know if I was getting Nice Guy Dave walking in the house or if I was getting the mad one. I would have liked it if it was consistent. He was a teacher. He was a teacher's teacher. Matter of fact, New York State hired him to teach teachers how to teach. That's how good he was. And he wrote curriculums for teachers of how to teach. And so in the classroom, it was all a controlled setting. Somebody else was the administrator of the school. Somebody else bought the books. Somebody else did all that. All he had to do was walk in, and the front was his stage, and he was in charge, and he was the most loved and beloved teacher. They voted him Teacher of the Year, year after year after year after year. But when he came home, he was in charge. And all the bills and all the finances and all the pressure and everything. And so at home, he was the exact opposite of what he was at school. Kids would say, your dad's my favorite teacher. I would say, my dad beats me. How do you like that? You see that wall? You see those indentations? That was a 5-year-old kid made those indentations. You know how? That's me going horizontal. So, you know, but I didn't say those things because I didn't want to dishonor my dad, because I went to a K-12 school. So if I say anything, I hurt my dad, hurt his chances for employment, and then I get it. So I just clammed up. And that was my life for 8 years till my mother came in one time and saw me flying across a kitchen, I think, took us away. And so for me, father was a 4-letter word. Father was not a good thing. Father was, matter of fact, my friends, I had one friend with a good father. All the other fathers I knew beat their children, beat their wives, were drinkers, alcoholics, or womanizers. Every single man I knew outside of one, and then I had an uncle also. Otherwise, all I thought was that men got older, and they did whatever they wanted to do to whoever they wanted to do it. And then suddenly, at 19 years old, I meet God, and I'm supposed to sing, praise you, Father, bless you, Jesus. The Father's good. It's like, he's what? He is? Yes, he's good. He's loved you. He loves you with an everlasting love. Jesus might. I get along with him. He's got long hair, and I like that. And at that time, it was 1973, and my hair, when it was wet, came down to there. And it was dark. Oh, well. Some people like it, but I look in the mirror and go, who is that old man? Holy Spirit was cool, because I grew up Catholic, and it was the Holy Ghost. You never knew where it was. Could be in the closet. Holy Ghost is in the closet. Ooh. So Jesus and the Holy Ghost are pretty cool. The Father, he was always on the throne with long gray hair with some kind of a stick. It was like, that's for me. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's long like that so he can reach me wherever I go. I just, you know, so I had to go through some changes of what the Father was. One of the great things is in Luke 15, a lot of people need that. Verse 1, all the tax collectors and sinners drew near to hear him. I've got two groups of people here. I've got tax collectors who are the lowest of the low. I mean, they were tax collectors, weren't Romans. The tax collectors were your Jewish brothers who took the job, and the only way that they could make a profit was to make sure you paid too much and that they would keep the extra. Okay? So I can tell you right now, the other Jewish believers or other Jews did not like the tax collectors. And then it says here, sinners. Isn't sinners just a nice little word? Does anybody here have a different word for sinners? I'm saying in your translation, most of you say sinners, right? If you look up the Greek word, it's used all throughout the New Testament. And guess what word it's used for? A lot. Harlot. But they cleaned it up when they translated it. It's the tax collectors and the harlots came to hear Jesus. Okay? They have to hear it. Why? Because all they know, tax collectors, all they know is authority is bad. I have to appease authority by, excuse my French here. Someone is French. I don't know. That's what we say here. But I have to appease the authorities by screwing my fellow citizens. Catch me? So the only way that I can make them happy is I do something that hurts people that are around me, and I do this because I'm fearful of this authority. And then you have the harlots who are just used to being used and abused by men in authority or any man in general. So you've got them coming, and they're going, we hear about him, but we have to hear what he has to say. By the way, how long do I have? I know they always say that, but then at a certain point, church body clocks go off, and then you go like this. No matter what it is. Our church ends at 12:30. 12:29, you're with me. 12:31, you're gone. Your body's here, but you're gone. Now, football is gone, and hockey's not a big sport here, so... Oh, sorry. Okay. Okay. I will do that. I'll be done before that. By the way, do you know what it means when a preacher takes his watch off and puts it on right in front of him like here? It means absolutely nothing. And don't worry, I will not have you turn to your neighbor and say something. Okay, here we go. I watched a guy preach one time. He said it 47 times. I counted. Actually, I stopped counting at 47. Turn to your neighbor and say, finally my wife and I would just look and go, Okay. I think that's good now and then, but it was just kind of funny. Verse 2, the Pharisees and scribes complained. Okay, so now we've got two sets of people to come to hear Jesus. The tax collectors and, sorry, I'm pointing to this side. The tax collectors and sinners, harlots, and tax collectors, and the scribes and Pharisees. I don't know which side you'd rather be on, but right now it's working. That's how it goes. And he spoke to them, but look what he says. He spoke to them this parable. Does anybody have a Bible that's in red when Jesus speaks? Is the rest of the chapter in red? Is there one parable then, or are there three parables? He said, he spoke this parable, okay? Now, I want you to hear something. I believe the whole chapter is one parable with three stories in it. And if you catch this, you catch something about the heart of God that you don't catch if you scoot right to verse 14 or verse 11 and do the parable of the prodigal son. If you go and skip the first two, you miss what the third one is about, because the third story is part of a larger parable. Okay? What man has 100 sheep if he loses one, does not leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after the one which is lost till he finds it? I'm also a teacher. I taught junior high for years. Still, sorry. Okay. I'm okay. I love that age group because we're old enough to have great conversations, and yet they're young enough to be intimidated by a 6'2" guy. So that's just how it works. But I like pictures. And so when Jesus tells a story, I go to the picture. And in here, in my mind, I see this little sheep. He's kind of walking around with the others going, man, I hate it here. Because what do you mean? We got the greatest shepherd. No, he controls us. Leadership always controls. Doesn't control. He lets us out every day. He takes us to the freshest water, takes us to the greenest grass. It's great. And then the time the wolves came, remember that? He just beat them off. He protected us. No, it's control. He does those things. He set them up to come to look like he's protecting us. But I'll tell you, let me say, you know what? If you go down that little ledge and go up those rocks, I think there's better water up there. And I bet on the other side of that hill is greener grass. But he's controlling us, because that's what leadership does. Isn't that what we do? That's what we do. That's what leadership does. The sheep's going, no, I don't think so. He goes, oh, yeah, I'm busting out. So at night, he goes over to the fence and takes his little sheep butt. Night after night. Finally, about the fifth, sixth night. Oh, yeah. Pushes out his little. And the others are going, stop, don't do it. He goes, I got it. You guys are stooges. I know it's right. And boom, off he goes. And they're all going, bye. And they all go over, pull the fence back, put it in place. And he's gone. And then the shepherd comes, where's it? They take their little sheep hoofs and they all point in the same direction. I don't know. He's over there. So he leaves them in a safe place and goes out and he finds them and he's telling this story. Now you gotta understand, who is this story to? Tax collectors, harlots, scribes, and Pharisees. It tells you who he's talking to. And any good speaker is gonna look out and say, oh, here's my audience. I am going to direct a story that's for them. He's not going to tell them a story for someone else. God's into your story and directing his voice to your story. Amen. Okay? And so they're out there and they're listening, and the tax collectors and harlots are going, oh, I know who that one's about. Yeah, that's us. Oh, yeah, it sure is. And the scribes and Pharisees are going, I know who that's about. Yeah. Yeah, I hope you guys are hearing this. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's about them, isn't it, guys? Oh, yeah, it's about them. Yeah. Yeah. Jesus goes on and goes, and then he comes upon the sheep, and Billy Bob Pharisee goes, can I finish the story? I live in Nashville now. I'm sorry, Billy Bob. So he goes, can I finish the story? And Jesus, now this is not really in here, but I'm going there because I like to make up stories. He goes, yeah, sure, Mr. Pharisee, go ahead and finish the story. So the shepherd comes on the sheep, finds the sheep on the ground, and he's hurt. And so he comes over, and he takes a stick and beats the sheep until it's covered in blood, goes over and breaks its leg so it will never run away again, picks him up, brings him back to the other sheep, throws it in front of the other sheep, and says, that's going to happen to you if you run away. There, how's that? Jesus, you see, because that was my father's image. And that's their father's image. And Jesus goes, well, actually, no, it's a little different. Actually, the father came down and tended to the sheep, made sure he was okay, picked him up and carried him so that his legs and hooves were against his chest so that the sheep could feel the heartbeat of the shepherd. And he brought him home, and he set him down safe, and he said, now there, let's have a party, because he's back. And the scribes and Pharisees are going, what? It's horrible. And the tax collectors and sinners are going, party? No wonder they told me to come listen to Jesus. I like him. They partied. This is awesome. He goes to the next story and says, Or what woman having 10 coins? Now, here's one that we never talk about. It's in Scripture, and we never talk about it. What woman has 10 silver coins? She loses one coin, doesn't light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully till she finds it. When she finds it, she calls her friends and neighbors, rejoice. Well, what does that have to do with anything? Why the story? It's not like, it's not like the coin has got little legs. I'm breaking out. You know, do you have a coin? I reached in my pocket. I didn't have a coin. It's because I changed. Oh, there we go. That's nice. That's a, as opposed to a loony. Now, you don't see the coin doing this. I'm getting out of here. Breaking out. I refuse to be bound to the inside of his pocket. You know, first of all, there wasn't a coin in a pocket. It was a coin on a woman. She had 10 silver coins, right? Somehow lost one. Well, here's the thing. Not being a woman, my wife is, my mother was, and all three daughters of mine are. So I know what it's like to shop. And here's the thing. Men shop for clothes. Women shop for 1,000 different things. The biggest one is accessories. Sometimes who cares about the clothes? It's the accessories. Am I right? Okay, thank you very much. And so in this particular case, this woman has, it says she had 10 silver coins. When I did research on this, it's probably a 10-coined, each one's a drachma, silver, and it's 10 coins that was in some kind of a necklace that she would wear, showing that the coins themselves encased in something that gave it, and highlighted the beauty of the coin, highlighted the beauty of the silver. All right, now, let me ask you a question. If you've got a necklace, ladies, and let's say that this one right here is missing, are you going to wear that necklace?
No.
Is your necklace worthless? You've got 9 silver coins left, right? Is it worthless? No, but you're not going to wear it, are you? Is it worth less? Yes, but it's not worthless, right? No, it's a strong... So what does she do with that necklace? She doesn't put it out to show everyone, look what I lost, right? She takes it and hides it away in a drawer somewhere, and what does it collect? Dust. Not interest, dust. What woman loses one coin, still has others? And the tax collectors and sinners are going, I don't understand this story. I don't have coins like that. Is it because I get coins? No, and the guys over here, they're spiritually clueless, so they're going, that can't be about me because it sounds negative. Follow me here. One is lost, the sheep is lost where? Outside the shepherd's house. Where's the coin lost? In the house. Tax collectors, sinners, scribes, and Pharisees. Who's lost, and yet they're a part of the house? Scribes and Pharisees. And he goes, how do you find and how do you redeem yourself when you're lost, when you're worth so much, you have no clue how much you're worth, and yet because you've removed something from the whole grid of who you are, you've removed compassion, mercy, you remove that aspect of who you are in God, when that happens, you're not worthless, but you are worth less. And your effectiveness in my kingdom is as if you were locked in a drawer collecting dust. And the only way that you're going to get out of that is if you light a lamp. Light a lamp means revelation. Sweep the house, remove that which is negative in your life, and then search God for who you're supposed to be. Isn't that awesome? And he just presents this wonderful story. Now, will you do that? They go, no? Relinquish power and might? No. And they're over here going, would you do this? Would you come back to the shepherd? And they're going, yes, I can't wait. And then we get to the third story. What's the third story about? It's about two sons, one that got lost outside the father's presence, and the older brother who is lost in the father's presence. He gave his inheritance to both of them, not just the younger, if you read it, and he gave to them their inheritance. They are both filled with the power of God. One relinquishes it and goes out to sin. The other ignores it, puts it in a drawer, doesn't care about it, only cares about his friends, those around him that believe the same system. And in that system, they don't even need their father who is right there. Religion removes the need for relationship from God even when he's right there. You can come to church every Sunday, and the only time you're amening and worshiping and connecting is the two and a half hours that you're in the building. Outside of here, your friendships have removed from you the need to relate to Papa. And then you look down your nose at somebody else who's struggling with a religious spirit. When the fact of the matter is, what you deem as liberty is actually a religious spirit because you remove the need for God to connect to you. Not that any of us would do that. And he has two sons, and we know the story. We know what happened. I don't even want to get into the prodigal thing. All I want to know is, verse 17, he comes to himself. He goes, okay, now, I know, I'm going to go back to my father. I'm going to rise and go to my father. In verse 18, I'm going to say, Father, I sinned against heaven and against you. Number two, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Number three, make me like your servants. He gets home. He's almost home, and the father is out front. And I don't think the father is a lazy man. I think he's probably a hardworking guy, and he's looking out there going, hope he comes home. Hope he comes home. I want to stay out here. I want to be right here. I just know he's going to be there. And after a while, he goes, I don't want to stand out here by myself. There's work to do. This grass needs, give me a sickle. Oh, sir, you're the man. No, give me a sickle. So he's out there working away, drinking lemonade now and then, looking for his son to come home. Finally, he sees this. You know how it is from a long ways away? You can tell someone by the way they walk. I had twins in my class, Carl and Ralph. From 200 yards, identical twins, 200 yards away, I could tell who they were by the way they walked. Carl would walk like this, and Ralph would walk like this. And I could tell who is who. And he's looking and going, that could be my boy. That could be my, it's my boy. From that moment of revelation and understanding, the father takes off running. Now, if you just read that and don't know Jewish culture, you think that's such a sweet thing. It's not a sweet thing. Why? The father ran to him. Jewish culture had three people that were allowed to run. Children, women, and soldiers. Okay? That's why they say, gird up your loins. Do you know what it means to gird up your loins? It's not a dirty word. Gird up your, I thought it was. I thought it was like, ooh, I don't know what that means. I'm not going to gird up my loins. I don't care what you say. No. Good. Back then, they didn't wear pants. They wore long, and they still do, long garments, correct? So you would take it, and you would pull it, and to gird it up would mean to put it underneath basically the girdle kind of area, the belt. You would put it up in there so you would expose your legs so that you could run. That's what it means. It's just a simple, simple term, and that's what it means. It means to gird up your loins, get ready for battle. Prepare yourself to run. And so because no one ran unless they were a child, a servant, or a soldier, the son is walking home. I'm going to say to my father, I've sinned against heaven and earth, and I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of you. Oh, it's my dad. He's running with a sickle. No. I don't know if he had a sickle or not. All I know is the father ran to the son. At that point in time, in Jewish culture, the son would automatically think, that man is at war. He's girded up his loins, and he's going to battle. What we don't hear in the story is this. The son chose to stay and die rather than go back. I would rather die in my father's presence than live outside of it. And the father comes, and it says he leapt on him. Now, it says he fell on him. He didn't just fall. He leapt on him. And then it says he kissed him. And I taught grammar. So I looked up the word kiss. It's a present progressive verb. Do you know what present progressive means? It means he kissed him and 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 kissed him. And every kiss was a kiss away of sin. And he kissed him and kissed him and kissed him until finally, you know how it is when someone's kissing you? Okay, like your dog. Stop. And he kissed him and kissed him. And you know the rest of the story. He's brought in and he's given everything. The robe, the ring, sandals, everything. And heard this story, heard about this lavishing God who lavishes affection. I said, God, I want that with my father. And he said, then it's time to forgive him. I said, I don't think you understood me, God. I want this with my father. I want him to change. Then I think you need to forgive him. God, I don't think you fully understand. This was my father. This was a cruel man. Yes, but it's time for forgiving. Okay, then I'll wait for him. No, you'll go to him. But God, but Chris. I'm God. I'm not. So I went to his house, July 4th, 1982. Get out there for July 4th, Independence Day picnic. And I'm standing next to my, I go out, and my dad is next to his garden. He always loved his garden. And I get to the house. I'm married now. I've got one child with one on, no, I just had my second child born. I'm standing next, I see my dad out there, and I know I the Lord said, forgive him today. Oh, God. Okay. I'm bigger than he is, so. What have we got to lose? So I go up and I stand next to him. By this time, we have a cordial relationship. I'm now grown. He's 5'8". I'm 6'2". I'm not worried anymore. So it's a respectful one. I respect him because he is my father, and I would visit him because I do have a wife and grandchildren, and I did those things, and I acted kindly. But I didn't forgive him. And I stood next to him, and I said, hi, Dad. He goes, hi. Shook my hand. He goes, garden's coming in good. And he started talking about the garden. I said, Dad, I need to tell you something. He goes, yeah, what's that? You know everything that happened when I was young and everything that happened between you and me and pain? And that, I didn't know how to say it. And that's how it came out. And it was quiet. And he didn't say a thing. And I'm standing there going, oh, what a stupid idea. Wait a minute. This is God's idea. I better not say it was stupid. So I'm standing there going, oh, it still feels stupid. And he suddenly goes, yeah, I remember. I said, well, I just wanted to tell you that I love you and I forgive you for anything and everything that happened. And I love you. And he said nothing. And I stood next to my dad and he said nothing. And the Lord said, put your arm around him. And I said, get thee behind me. He said, no, it's me. Put your arm around him. So I'm like, oh, I feel like a 14-year-old at a movie theater. You know? So I put my arm around him. The second my hand hit his shoulder, he slumped and began to weep. And I had to hold him up. And as he's weeping, he realizes, I'm working so hard to hold him up. He takes his left hand out and puts it around the back of me to hold on to me so he doesn't fall. And now I'm holding him up. And the second he touches me, I start to weep. And we're weeping, and we're weeping. And he's just, these tears are coming out. And there's 30 people in the family back there cooking hot dogs and hamburgers. And I don't know what we look like, but we're just like this. And it goes on for 1 to 2, 3 minutes. And finally, I just went, you know, Dad, nice carrots. And he goes, he just realized instantly what I just did. He goes, yeah, did you see my corn? And we start We start wiping our eyes by pointing at vegetables and flowers. We get all done in the day, and we just, and that was it. We never spoke about that moment again, never spoke about anything again in the past. When it went time to go home, I don't know why, I'd never done it. I'd always shook his hand. I just leaned in, didn't think about it, just like church. Just gave him a big hug. He goes, "Oh, I like that." He goes, "I want that every time." So every time I came to see him, I would hug him. And then I went away on a trip to a Catholic charismatic community for a couple weeks, and everybody kisses there. I didn't like it at first because the first one to kiss me was Brian. Brian came up, gave me a kiss, and I went, "Okay, what was that about?" He goes, "I'm sorry. Romans 16:16, greet one another with a holy kiss. That's what we do here. It's a sign of respect." I said, "Okay." So other guys and gals, and finally by the end of 2 weeks, I'm kissing everything and dogs, trees, didn't matter. I'm kissing it. I get back to my dad's house, knock on the door, open the door. "Hey, Dad, how you doing?" I go to give him a hug. Whacko, boom, give him a big kiss. It's in the middle of my lips on his cheek when I think, "Oh, I'm kissing my father." And he goes, "That was different." He goes, "Just a second, let me try something." He comes up, kisses my cheek. He goes, "Let's keep that. I like that." During this time, my father came back and said, "By the way, I prayed that prayer at the end of the number show." "The number show? The roulette thing for the numbers for the lottery? What number show?" "You know, the 007 thing. 00700 club." He goes, "Yeah, yeah. I prayed the prayer at the end of the 700 club about receiving Jesus. I just thought you would want to know." Yeah. Yeah. So for 10 years, this is not going to... Can I take 5 extra? Is that okay? For 10 years, my father and I hugged and kissed each other every time we saw each other. I remember one time pulling up to the house and the drapes were pulled back. And they went down and I pulled in the driveway. By the time I got in the driveway, the door was being opened so he could pull me out to kiss me. Marion, he had been remarried. Marion, his wife, said he had waited there over 45 minutes. Because he said, "I can't wait to kiss my son." He gets a report about his lungs, something's wrong. I went to the hospital with him. They did a couple of different outpatient surgeries. I held his hand and prayed with him while he was going through this. They were trying to get a specimen. They couldn't do it. They brought him in. They're going to take him under general anesthesia. I know it sounds like I worked a lot of places, but I worked in that hospital. I'd worked there for 6 years as a surgical assistant. I wanted to go into medicine. I loved medicine. And I'd done this particular surgery and helped out a bunch of times. It was just called a lung biopsy. It's an hour from skin to skin, from the beginning to the end. It's real, real fast. He had to go in for the lung biopsy, and I wheeled him down to the holding room. I'm standing there, and his wife Marion is here, and he's there. And all the masked men come out from the room. The attending surgeon, resident, third-year medical student, anesthesiologist, they're all there. My dad's laying his head here, and he's there. We've spent 10 years now hugging and kissing each other. He says, "Now, time to say goodbye to your husband." So Marion leans over and gives him a kiss. "I love you, Dave." And I reach in, and I've worked with these guys, okay? So I have to be cool. Now, I'm stupid to do this, but I wanted to be cool. So I reach over and give him one of these kind of shakes. "Here, put your hand up. Hey, you know, like a manly thing." And so my dad takes it like this, and he goes, "What?" I said, "What do you mean, what?" He goes, that's not good." I said, "What?" And I'm going like this. He goes, come here. And so he takes the back of my head and pulls me into the stretcher, except for the toe of 1 foot. Now, I don't know, but in Hollywood, stretcher sides are always down. Not so in real life. They're up, and they're that thick, tiny, and they're made of hard steel. So it goes across here, and that just cut right across my 137 pounds on that side. Yeah, I know. It's a couple. Somebody went on that side. I saw that. I saw that. Thank you very much. It makes me. Anyway, so he reaches in, and he just takes my head, and he kisses my cheek, and he turns. He turns my head and points at the doctors. He goes, "That is my son, and I love him. Wow. And I'm like, oh, I've waited my whole life. I just love you, Dad. And he goes, he starts to let me go. He goes, nah, that's not enough. And he pulls me in a second time, and he just looks at me straight on, and I'm going, oh, no. I know what's coming, and it's going to be a lip kiss. Fortunately, he did half and half. I went, boom! He goes, I love you. And the doctors hadn't moved. They should have been scrubbing in. They're like, this is unbelievable. And so he goes, okay, now I can go. So they start to wheel him away. It was about from here to that wall away. They're wheeling him going this way, and he gets to about the third row here. And my dad shouts out, stop, stop! And they stop the stretcher, and the girl stops the stretcher. And the doctors stop, and they look back like, what is going on? And my dad goes, you have to turn me around. I can't see my son when I'm faced this way. So they turn the stretcher around. He's now facing me, and they're pulling him backward. And the nurse is laughing hysterically, and my father goes, so I blow him a kiss, and he goes, and I go, then he does this. He starts shooting love bullets at me. And they're just clinging and pinging off. I'm going like this, and the doctors haven't moved. I finally look over, and they're just going, yes. I didn't care. I just ate it all up. And they pull him into the elevator, and it wasn't two doors like this. You know, it's one coming from one side. So they pull him in, and they pull him kind of in the middle, and it starts to close, and he goes, as the door's closing, and he kisses his thumb, and he goes like that. And my dad died on the table. I have a kissing. I'm crazy about you. I'm not ashamed to tell anybody how much I love you. I want to hug you. I want to turn the stretcher around so I can see your face. That's my papa. And through my dad, this papa is a kissing, loving, I want to tell you how much I love you. I want you to know it until you know it, until you're sick of knowing it. And when you're sick of it, you'll finally start to get it. I want you to know how much I love you. So do me a favor, Chris, and go out and get some sand and have sand in your house. And I have sand in my house. And it tells me every day how many times more he thinks of me. Good thoughts, loving, embracing thoughts than I could ever think. Do me one last favor. Hey, Paul, would you throw that? I just want to put a song on. And I want you to close your eyes for a second. Maybe it'll give you a chance to get your tissue out. But I just want you to close your eyes and let God touch you where you need to be touched, like Jesus spoke to who needed to be spoken to. Go ahead, you can start it. Number 9. He can speak directly to you exactly where you need it.
Father's time.